It was around the time I first started doing these.
Yeah, 2011. That's our time.
Yeah, that was definitely our time. Oh boy, what's happened to us? I don't know. With me, returning to the program, the always welcome Sawyer Paul. Sawyer, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be here. I'm excited.
Yeah, we have some exciting things to talk about. Some exciting matches that occurred. In the past, they did occur in the past, and they didn't really, they were not built up in any extraordinary way, nor did they lead to anything extraordinary within themselves, but they existed and they were fun, and we're going to talk about them.
Yeah, I think both of these matches, and you could definitely make a long playlist of these, but like, not necessarily one-offs, because I think both of these matches happened multiple times, but rarely, and neither ever had like a real proper story between them. And I think that's a fascinating sort of like rare thing in wrestling, is like you get two people who, for whatever reason, their careers just never really collide. They never really get a months-long story to tell. But every now and then you get like a fun one-off match because of circumstance or just whoever's available that night, maybe.
Yeah, or they want to get a rating. So like, oh, these guys haven't wrestled before. Why not do that? You know, that'll be novel.
Sure.
That kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yes, they're always the business considerations. But yeah, it is... Yeah, they're noteworthy in their rareness. I think mm-hmm. Goldberg and Sting may have wrestled like three times. They mm-hmm. would wrestle. This is their first matchup in 98 that we're going to talk about. September 14th, 1998 Nitro. And then I think Rey Mysterio and John Cena had only wrestled once before on SmackDown in 2003. And I don't think they wrestled again. I could be wrong about that. But so we are definitely talking about matches that are extremely rare.
Very rare. Yeah.
Yeah. So the first one, the Goldberg Sting match, this is a very interesting time in WCW history, and you're not likely to find a time in WCW history that isn't interesting. So I guess maybe I'm, you know, not saying anything interesting there, but this is the same night as Ric Flair returning from months of being in the wilderness, so to speak, returning after he'd been suspended by Eric Bischoff. There was a big to-do that we don't need to get into because
am I right?
Yes, it was quite the it was quite the time, and a lot of electricity going on in the building with this night. People, once this match was announced that very night, people were very excited about it. Goldberg had been champion for about 2 months. He was still right at the peak of his popularity, and but was kind of had, even though he'd won the championship, and kind of, you know, usually that kind of leads to a new era or kind of a change in focus on the shows. The shows really hadn't changed much. He was kind of just doing the same thing, trading water, wrestling the Giant a few times, but hadn't even been on Fall Brawl the night before. Was kind of Not an afterthought, but certainly wasn't a focus at that point.
Yeah, the Giant or Big Show, as most people know him now, he was kind of fed to Goldberg as his first major title story after Hogan, right?
Yeah, but they didn't even do it. Yeah, I mean, theoretically, yes, but they didn't really. It was never made like a prominent thing. I think they did main event a Nitro, but it was not a. It was definitely. They were half-assing a lot during that period, and that was even half-assing the half-ass. So,
it's true. They quarter-assed that. But yes. I think it sparked what has been a long tradition of when someone wins the title and they want them to have the title for a little while, the first person that they feed to that new champion is usually the Big Show.
Yes, or I think Kane would take that role sometimes.
Or Kane,
in WWE.
Yes.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, yeah. One of those two.
Yeah.
That's usually challenger one or two, those two.
Yeah, that is definitely a giant role. That is definitely that is a good observation. And and Sting was somewhat tangentially involved with this whole with the Goldberg Giant situation, because he had joined the NWO, the Wolfpack side, the good guy NWO, earlier that spring. Also kind of not doing much, was wearing red face paint, and you know, was with the Wolfpack were Kevin Nash, Conan, Lex Luger, Randy Savage had been in it, but I think he was hurt by this point, so he wasn't really around. I think that was basically about it for the...
This is the post-Savage, pre-Disco Wolfpack.
Oh, yes, Disco. I kind of forgot about Disco being in the Wolfpack, but he was, you know, he should not be forgotten. Disco Inferno, very important.
Very important Wolfpack character.
Yeah.
Yeah, if I recall, Sting joined the Wolfpack and then became tag team champions with NWO White and Black, the Giant?
Yes. I don't think the Giant was yet in the Black and White when they had
won. I think he joined the NWO during that match.
Yeah, it was a... Yeah, I used to have all the details of this straight in my head, but it's been almost 20 years now, and
it's been a while.
Yeah, I don't remember all the particulars of that, but I think we can say that it was a very muddled time, and this whole NWO Hollywood faction Hogan was leading versus the Wolfpack feud that had been theoretically raging for months was listless, to put it best.
Yeah, it always confused me that they made it two NWOs and they seem to not like each other, but they also seem to not fight each other all that often. And they both seem to not like WCW the same amount. And they both kind of just got fed to Goldberg.
Yeah, to a degree, although, again, they weren't really – Goldberg was not – this wrestling Sting here was a very notable exception to the idea that Goldberg was not generally interacting with the top-level wrestlers. He was, you know, interacting with guys who were, you know, like a tier below that. The Hogan title win also, of course, being a notable exception.
Yeah. No, I mean, he was sort of on the Giants level, whereas, you know, 9 or 10 down on the
right.
card.
Yes.
Yeah,
exactly. So it was, but Sting also kind of felt very maybe just undermined to a degree by being part of this faction where he wasn't doing much. He was just, you know, he was standing around. He was doing hand gestures and just kind of being around. But he wasn't really even necessarily the focus for that. For the most part, it was really Nash, you know, was kind of the focus and getting the microphone time, and Sting was just kind of hanging out and you know, not really doing much along with it.
If I recall, the sort of the order went, it was Kevin Nash versus Scott Hall at that period of time. That was sort of the important story.
Yes.
Wolfpack wise and then there was Conan yelling at no one, and then three wrestlers down it was Sting wondering why he was there.
That is pretty much the issue. He was about to get embroiled in a little bit of a thing with Bret Hart, which we'll get into at the end here. But
yes,
but yeah, it was definitely kind of a period with a lot of guys kind of wandering around, wondering what they were doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of, you could describe WCW in mid to late 98 as a bunch of guys wandering around not knowing what they were doing.
Yes. And Sting had been just a few months earlier about as hot as Goldberg was at this point. I mean, he had they obviously had built him up for a year and a half to challenge for Hogan, and we've talked about, you know, what happened there. But, you know, every month or so after that, he kind of cooled off, and people mm-hmm. it was Sting, people liked him, but he, you know, mm-hmm. there was not the sense of specialness that he had had for so long. He had definitely escaped, and Goldberg had, you know, taken that spot of specialness. It really is remarkable how well WCW handled Goldberg for that first year of not really doing much with him. For the most part, it was right, this is getting to the point where not doing too much with him started to become a bit of a problem for him.
Mm-hmm.
But
mm-hmm.
before that, they just did enough with him where they didn't expose him to, for the most part, to doing anything that he couldn't do. They were pretty, you know, they played it pretty straight with him, and it obviously, with the charisma that he had, the connection they had with people, the physicality he had, it just worked, you know, bonkers. It's really hard to undersell how electric the atmosphere is around him, you know, during this match, especially during the beginning and the entrance.
I sometimes forget how Like, I'll watch a Raw or a SmackDown these days or a hot pay-per-view, and I'll think, wow, this crowd is really electric. And then I'll go back and watch a Nitro from 98, and it's the amount of shit being lost in this crowd for what is, what, a one-star match? Like, is insane to me. They went crazy for everything.
Yeah.
So yeah, Sting was definitely very over. His red motif, like his, this palette swap red Sting is the ugliest wrestler of all time.
It's not good.
The way he's wearing his hair is terrible. Like, he's still got the long black hair of his, like, crow Sting, but he's not, like, watering it or gelling it down. It's not slick. It's just poofy. I don't get it. It's a weird hairstyle. And the red that he's gone with just looks like it's the worst Halloween costume, and he's wearing it all the time. And it's not just that he's wearing red face paint. That would be bad enough. It's that all of the highlights on his outfit are the same terrible fake blood red.
Yeah, it's not ideal. It's no. It was not. They definitely trying to shoehorn him in, and I'm sure they sold a lot of red NWO t-shirts during that year. So they probably the whatever sacrifice they did to Sting's character probably was made up for in t-shirt sales. But it definitely it just felt like a waste.
Yeah, and he's, what's weird is during this period, and this is the only period that I know of when he's in like dark Sting mode anyway, he's not wearing gloves. The white and black outfit, he wore gloves. And here he is just like he's got this crazy outfit, and he just has these like little tiny hands. Like, they seem really small compared to when he's wearing gloves.
Yeah. Maybe they just didn't have the red gloves, you know, in the right shade.
Yeah, they couldn't spray paint some gloves. Yeah, definitely.
If you can't match the outfit, I mean, what's the point? Yeah.
He's also got on one of those very 1998 little bead necklaces.
Yes.
So that's your fashion report.
Yeah, it's a good one. I like it, yeah. So DDP is on commentary along with the usual crew of Tony Giovanni, Bobby Heenan, and Mike Tenay. He doesn't give some depth on his first experiences with Goldberg as Goldberg was trying to break into WCW. Not really much insight, but you get the idea that they, you know, there's a connection there. He was impressed by Goldberg. And he's reasonably impressive and insightful to begin with, but as the match goes on, less so, for sure.
DDP is not a natural commentator. He runs out of steam about 5 minutes in,
which is
like almost half the match. I love that Goldberg, on his entrance, Goldberg has a habit of slipping sometimes.
Yes, he does.
And right after he gets out the door, he's walking with security, and you can just see him slip just a little bit. Like, there's just a little bit of slippage there. And then he composes himself. He gets up. I don't recall him ever like slipping and falling down in WCW, but he did once or twice in WWE.
Yes.
But it always seems like he's about to.
Just on the precipice, yes.
So I don't know if you watched Monday Night Raw in 2016, 2 weeks ago, when fucking Goldberg was on the show again. What happened? What has happened to our life, Jason? What happened? He slipped again. He fought Rusev, and then he stood up and he did a thing and he slipped. He slipped again.
Goldberg keeps slipping. What can we say? I don't know if there's a I don't know if it's a harbinger for problems that he had or if it's just like a one off thing. I mean, he looked pretty good physically. Other than that,
he's a specimen of the human condition. He's one of the best built people. Yeah. Period. Right. Now and then he just like slips and falls.
Right. I feel like Cena does the same thing, where Cena is just slightly, like, just slightly clumsy for an athlete. And this is obviously compared to, like, athlete terms. But,
yeah.
Yeah, it's a weird common thing that they seem to have.
I never see any other wrestlers slip.
If they're coming off the top rope or something like that. If it's a cruiserweight doing, like, a fancy move or whatever. But, yeah, just basic. Yeah.
But Goldberg slips walking. So...
It's a mystery. It's an enigma. It's Goldberg.
I love that. Also, when he's walking to the ring, the security like walks him all the way to the ring too. They usually left him at the entrance, but in this match they walked him like to the ropes basically.
That is interesting. I don't think they did that for very long. I feel like because at some point they introduced the security entrance part of it. That component was, I think, relatively new at the point. I don't think they did that. They'd been doing that for very long, but I think they did cut it to the point where, yeah, he would get to the entrance and then we kind of do it all by himself, which kind of made sense. I mean, I think the idea of the security around him was just to kind of make him seem like a big deal, but it also kind of made him like, it was weird because no other wrestler has security. So why does this big tough guy need security with him? It was sort of a strange, like, it made sense in a certain level, but it always kind of came off as a little bit like different is good, but it was almost like a little too different.
I always kind of looked at the security that would accompany him to the ring as a boxing reference.
Right.
Because when boxers came to the ring, they always had like an entourage of people with them. And security is always definitely a part of that. I recently went back and I watched WrestleMania 4 because every few years it's weird. It's magical. Every few years, WrestleMania 4 gets 30% better. And so I watched it a little while ago, and it was a little bit better than the last time I'd seen it. Every single time this happens. And they had security at the Trump Plaza. They have security flanking every single wrestler.
But those entrances are pretty narrow, if I recall correctly. And it's also like this big, you know, they have to go down all these steps to get to the ring. So, yeah,
speaking of slippage, there is one step in the entrance in WrestleMania 4 that almost every wrestler almost trips over.
Yes. that is true.
Anyways.
WrestleMania 4 is one of my favorite was one of my favorite shows as a child, so I've seen it many times. Yeah. So it's a splendid one.
It's becoming one of my favorite shows as an adult.
Yeah. It's the wrestling is not particularly good on it, but everything else is so fun.
But it's zippy. Not one match is more than 3 minutes.
Yes. You know.
It has an amazing pace.
So, as far as this match goes, I think I might like it a bit better than you do. Because I don't think it's, like, fantastic or anything, but I think it's a nice, it's a nice, you know, encounter within the Goldberg framework. But they do kind of some interesting things. I think Sting they do a nice job of making you think Sting could actually win it. I'd kind of forgotten about there's actually interference in the finish of the match, and which, you know, it's the first time in which I think there's your Goldberg's losing streak seems like it's in serious jeopardy to a person who you think, okay, I guess he could, you know, Sting is a guy who could actually break that streak.
Sure, maybe. I mean, he would have been on the list of people that people would have talked about.
Sure.
At the time.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I think if you compare Nitro main events, this one does probably rank as one of the maybe top 25 Nitro main events, because most Nitro main events aren't very good. The stereotype of Nitro being like an hour of good cruiserweight wrestling and 2 hours of NWO nonsense is not false. And this is one of the rare, in 1998, very rare main events that actually happened on Nitro.
Yes.
Like most main events would get announced and then not happen the way that they announced them, or something crazy would happen, or they would start it and there would be a crazy schmoz. This match doesn't end clean, but it goes for a while at least before that happens.
It ends with a pinfall.
Ends with a pinfall. But yeah, let's go through it. What's funny is if I may, usually do the play-by-play, but if I may, I can take this one. I'm not usually a play-by-play guy, but I feel like I can handle this match pretty well. I counted it up. Most people don't do this with play-by-play. I counted up the number of wrestling moves in this match.
Mm-hmm.
It's 26.
Yeah.
It's 26 wrestling moves. There's some counters and reversals. I'm not counting those. But there's 26 wrestling moves divided equally by both guys.
So 26 wrestling moves in 9 minutes. That is a move speed of about, it's close to 3 moves per minute. That's
Is that good? Is that good move speed wise for you?
That doesn't seem like it's great move speed wise, no, but I enjoyed
slow,
the match.
Right?
But
at some point I didn't have time before the recording to do the same breakdown for the next match we're doing, but I'm going to assume that the move speed ratio for John Cena and Rey Mysterio is slightly higher than 3 per minute.
I think it's fair to say, yes.
I think it's fair to say.
Yes.
So we start off with knees. Goldberg knees Sting after a lockup. They lock up, they do the collar elbow type, and then Goldberg hits him with some knees, and then he just power slams him. That's the basically the first wrestle. There's knees and then a power slam.
Yes.
Right away.
Yes.
Would it be kind of weird if you watched like a Raw main event in 2016 and like the first move is a power slam? Would that be odd to you?
Well, you're asking the wrong person because I don't really watch Raw anymore, but
sure.
But yeah, it is sort of a it's a big move for an introduction. I mean, it gets, you know, Sting down pretty quickly, and
yeah.
But it seems to fit the Goldberg template pretty well.
It does. I agree. It's one of the things I forgot about Goldberg is that he doesn't really have small wrestling moves in his repertoire. He only really has the big ones. So when he starts off with a power slam, I'm like, holy crap, we're starting off in gear 4 here. But that's Goldberg's beginning gear. And Sting kind of realizes this right away. And so he kicks him back and he delivers a buckle power slam in response. Right. So he there's a little bit of tete-a-tete there where he goes, okay, you're going to start this match power slamming me. I'm going to slam you into the buckle. Right. Which is, again, that's a Seth Rollins-y kind of move to do.
Sure.
A little ironic that a buckle bomb is what eventually ended Sting's career. But here we are with Sting throwing Goldberg into the buckle with a power slam. He picks him up, gives him a vertical suplex, and Goldberg just stands up. Doesn't sell the vertical suplex at all. Crowd goes apeshit for it.
Yes. Yeah, it's a very dramatic moment, and it fires everybody up. It's one of those ones where I think the popping up for the move is actually a good a good thing to do. Where, you know, I'm not always a fan of the no selling things, but I think when done in the right moments is it can be very effective, and I don't think it takes me out of, you know, the realism of a match.
No, it was one of the things that I think Goldberg gets away with.
Yeah, kind of like the Road Warriors would do. Like in their early days, they also, you know, and I feel like Goldberg is a similar phenomenon to the Road Warriors, you know, obviously of a different time and, you know, mm-hmm. the singles variety, but it's very much kind of the same. He had the same kind of raw, you know, magnetism that, you know, made the Road Warriors so appealing.
Absolutely. And much like the Road Warriors, Goldberg was mostly wrestled basically nobodies.
Right.
Right. And
yeah.
So he seems all the more impressive, especially when you just throw a ton of gooners at him.
Yeah. And he had interesting offense and, you know, good variety on moves, and that the guys who would, you know, the goobers that he would wrestle would take it really well and would make it look really powerful. I mean, there's definitely.
Absolutely.
There are people who think that Goldberg really sucked, and I don't agree with that. I mean, he was limited, and he obviously had his flaws, and there mm-hmm. were some performances that, you know, weren't particularly strong. But I do think that he was very, very good at certain aspects of wrestling, and managed to be incredibly memorable, you know, because mm-hmm. of that.
I think he had. I mean, I don't think anybody disagrees that 98 was Goldberg's year. But he had 3 or 4 very different, very good matches in 98. He had the really, really cool one against DDP that went a long time. That's like the long Goldberg match.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the one long one. There's this one against Sting. There's the one against Hogan, obviously, which is such an iconic match.
Yeah.
And then there's one against the Raven one, right, which is really great. And they're all 4 of them are very different, you know. And it if you watch them back to back to back, and you realize Goldberg actually has a lot more versatility than people give him credit for. And he's such a star. He's just such obvious money.
Yeah, the, no, absolutely. He really is. I mean, I do think that you can't take away the you can't dismiss the fact that he had that presence, that he had that. You know, not everybody has that. Not everybody, even people who might have it, don't know how to use it. And he definitely knew how to use it from the beginning.
Absolutely. So anyways, he no-sells it. They kick each other. Goldberg elbows Sting to the back of his head, which is just, it's good, brutal, big guy offense. And he delivers a shoulder tackle, which I love that. I love stuff like that from him. Whenever, like, I always feel, though, like when he does like a football-y thing, like, and the announcers don't refer to that as that, they're leaving money on the table because he's very much referencing his past there.
Yeah. Jim Ross would not have had a problem mentioning his football background.
He would not have. He would not have left that there. Sting counters by giving him a high drop kick, which, again, Goldberg just gets right back up, no sells it. Goldberg kicks him back, and then he delivers what Mike Tenay, or Schiavone, I believe, calls it a patented leg takedown.
Yes.
Which is Goldberg's, and he did this differently depending on the guy he was wrestling, but he would sort of hop up, give him a leg scissors, and take him down. And depending on who it was, it either looked really, really cool or really funny.
Yes.
But here it looks good. I think it looked good here.
Right.
Sting's really close to the ropes because the WCW ring is 2 feet by 2 feet, and he breaks it. That's what it looks like to me. It looks so tiny compared to the WCW ring now. Like the, yeah. I feel like the WCW ring shrinks 2 feet every year.
It's not the size of the ring. It's the size of the heart inside of it or something.
So Sting grabs a headlock. He counters out, gets a headlock, holds him in a headlock for like a little while, right? He moves him around a little bit.
Yeah.
Goes for what I feel is a, like he's going to bulldog him. Like he puts his feet up on the ropes as if he's going to bulldog Goldberg, but Goldberg just like shrugs him, just shoves him right off. And then they go into a test of strength for to like 10 seconds. Goldberg like just handily wins that.
Sure.
Moves him into the corner, knees him a little bit, and then, tell me if this is interesting, turns him around, or puts him upside down, goes for a tombstone pile driver, which Sting counters out of and hits his own tombstone pile driver.
Yeah. Sting loves the tombstone reversal. That's something he used to do that all the time with DDP. I know with a few other guys too, but that's one of his favorite moves. It looks really good, but it did seem odd for Goldberg to be doing
to be
a tombstone.
Going for it originally, right? Because
yes.
Goldberg is not someone to pile drive people. Like he's not a tombstone pile drive guy.
Yeah.
But the whole point of the move is because Sting loves to reverse into it.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure
I recall,
he and Rick Rude would do that too.
Yeah, definitely. I don't think Sting ever just goes for a pile driver by himself, though. Like, it's always out of something else.
Yeah, I feel like Sting does a conventional pile driver by himself, but the tombstone is always coming in a reverse position.
Yeah. Anyways, that puts the match in Sting's control. Goldberg reels back into the corner, and this is where we get two Stinger splashes in a row, which is for the young Stingers in the audience, this is where they go, hey, Sting might win this. I feel like there's a good moment here where you're like, this is really in Sting's control and he's got Goldberg's number.
Yeah.
You know,
this
hits him twice.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
I would say this is similar to the moment in the WrestleMania 31 main event, which we last talked about, where you can see that Roman Reigns has finally gotten to Brock Lesnar and like, oh, he might actually beat him. Like he might,
yeah.
You know, he's actually vulnerable. I feel like this was a similar type of feeling that the crowd had at this moment.
Yeah. There's gotta be a name for that. Someone asked Joe Drilling what the actual like official name is in wrestling parlance to this moment when you feel like the good guys got the match. It's not a hope spot because that's coming down from behind. Like Sting's on top of the match here.
Right.
Kicks, punches him again, hits another Stinger splash. That's three Stinger splashes. That's usually pretty good to throw somebody away, right? But Goldberg counters the fourth attempt at a Stinger splash by going for a spear. he misses the spear, hits the turnbuckle, and this is when you go, oh, definitely, okay, so Goldberg's made a mistake now. Now Sting's got it. Sting hits a chop block to the knee, which, that's not a good guy wrestling move. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, he's a little desperate here, though, so.
A little desperate, fine. Yeah. Puts him in the Scorpion Deathlock, which I feel like they start too close to the ropes, but maybe they move him a little, so it's fine. Goldberg doesn't really reach for the ropes, even though I feel like he totally could.
Yeah, he's kind of facing the opposite way, so I think it's okay, but I get what mm-hmm. you're saying.
Yeah. And that is when a wild Hulk Hogan appears.
Very wily, yeah.
Comes down from the entranceway, climbs up the steps, walks into the ring. The referee has full eyes on Hulk Hogan.
Well, theoretically, his head is turned the other way, but yes, it is difficult to...
But the ref is awake, right? He should hear it.
He is probably three feet from the referee, yes. Maybe closer than that, yeah.
I will say this about Bad Guy Hulk Hogan. I love his, like, skulking walk, where he's just like, ha ha ha, I'm up to no good walking.
Yes.
I love that. So he walks into the ring. I'm actually looking at the video feed right now. He walks right by the referee. The referee doesn't notice him at all. Hogan kicks Sting in the back, breaking the Scorpion Deathlock. Sting's down. Hogan, again, crawls away. Like a snake. I love him. This is the only time you'll hear me compliment Hulk Hogan is when he's doing his, like, ace bad guy work. Goldberg notices that Sting's down, goes for the spear, nails the spear.
Yes.
Still one of the best spears.
It's a great spear.
Business.
Yeah.
So good. Goes for the jackhammer. Hits it, pins him, 1, 2, 3. Kind of a bad guy win here. Because with the Hogan assist, I know that Goldberg didn't see Hogan, and that Hogan immediately beats up Goldberg as soon as the match is over, because it's Nitro. They have to have a schmozzy finish.
Sure. Yeah. One thing you didn't mention is that DDP on commentary is disgusted once Hogan gets involved, and then he goes away from the broadcast area, which for those who don't know is not by the ring, but is up by the stage. So he.
Right.
So I think that's noteworthy in his attitude toward he is, I guess, the voice of the fan there, of being mad at this interference happening in with this exciting match.
Sure. I thought the DDP was going to come down to the ring and help.
That's what I thought too. Yes.
Nope.
Apparently he's gone away though. Yeah, I guess he had to go away because it wouldn't have made sense for him not to come out if he hadn't have gone to the back and
Sure.
It's a little strange, but yes.
Instead, Bret Hart comes out hobbling because he's presumably injured, I guess. I don't know. I'm not really sure of the context of why he's hurt, but or that he was even a good guy at this point, because I thought in early 98 he joined the NWO White and Black.
I can explain that in a moment after we finish the description here. Yeah.
So Bret scares Hogan off, which I'm sure would have made me really excited, because I really wanted to see Bret and Hogan in WCW.
Right.
And I never really got to see that happen.
Yeah. Well, so, the only time they really do it is like in a week or two after this, where, it ends up being a ploy to lure Sting to get involved. And then Bret attacks Sting and it turns out that he is faking his, somehow he and, Hogan had some, he had not officially joined the NWO, but he had been on Hogan's side since he turned heel in April.
Right.
And then sometime around July or August, he had, I think he lost the U.S. title to DDP. And then after that, he beat DDP again with the Giants' help. And mm-hmm. then I think he may have had to forfeit the title or... something, yeah. I'm forgetting the exact details, but basically, he is a good guy to the crowd theoretically, but he is in the midst of a ploy to lure in Sting and then betray him. So I guess he's trying to be Ric Flair here, but not really doing it that well.
I love it.
Yes,
I love it. I love it.
I'm sure Bret Hart probably does not like that comparison, though.
Probably not.
No.
Probably neither does Ric Flair.
No, probably not. No, neither one of them who are surely listening to this probably are happy with me right now.
Right.
Yeah.
Hi, Nage.
Yes.
So Shivani mentions that this victory brings Goldberg up to 144-0, and my notes just have a bracket LOL bracket next to that.
Yes. They had started to, because at first they had actually had the real win total, but then by this point they had faked it.
I love it. They say he's a week away from being in wrestling for 1 year.
Right.
And he's 144-0.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you count house shows, he's wrestling 5 times a week. That actually would add up in the math. But
he didn't have 5 house shows a week.
Well, yeah, they did sometimes. I don't think Goldberg was on all of them, of course, but yes.
No.
I mean, a full-time wrestler schedule would be roughly, 220 matches a year or so. So that actually would that would theoretically add up, but
theoretically, but he wasn't on every Nitro. Yeah. certainly wasn't on every pay-per-view. Well,
at this point he was on every Nitro, but yes, to begin with he was not, for sure. Yeah. Yes. So, yeah, this is probably like the second biggest win of Goldberg's career up to that point. But yeah, they really did. Like, I do feel like if they had done something where Hogan like came out and Brett like went after him, and that provided like a momentary distraction for Sting, and then Goldberg had taken advantage, not really realizing what he was doing, but had hit the spear, and then, you know, if they had done it that way where Hogan hadn't actually gotten physically involved in such a silly way, I think it would have come off better. Although I guess part of the point was Goldberg is locked in the Scorpion Deathlock, and you think it's possible that he's going to submit, and then Hogan prevents that. So,
sure,
it didn't really make anybody look good other than Hogan, I guess.
Can you explain to me why Hulk Hogan interfered in this match? Wasn't he feuding with like the Warrior at this point?
Yes. Well, the Warrior was off that night, I think, because of a injury. So I guess he wants the title back. No, here's what it is. Paige mentions it, that he says that he's mad that he feels that Hogan is jealous of Goldberg. So, he's, I guess, jealous of both, but he doesn't want Sting to beat Goldberg because Goldberg beat him.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. That actually makes some semblance of sense.
It does make some semblance of sense in probably this case and this case only, because I'm fairly certain that Hulk Hogan was not continuously helping Goldberg win matches.
Yes, although I guess this is the Goldberg had not been at a point where he was vulnerable up until this point.
Oh, so. Okay. I'm enjoying this rewriting of history. The story is increasingly making good sense to me.
There you go.
I always thought that would be a really fun angle, is to have a bad guy keep helping a good guy win because the bad guy wants to be the one to beat the good guy.
Yeah.
Right? I always thought that would be a fun thing to try.
Yeah. I feel like elements of that have been done, but, I'm sure I feel like the Luger Sting when Luger was a bad guy, but pretending to be a good guy in front of Sting, I feel like there was some involvement of like, you know, Luger was helping Sting win matches and Sting didn't want him to, that kind of thing.
Sure. Yeah.
I feel like that premise has never been used in a like really, really well as a central part of a story. I mean, I'm sure it's happened here and there, but
you have to be careful because the good guy in that situation will either come, if you do it long term, the good guy will either come off looking like he's in on it, or he's an idiot.
Yes.
One of the two.
Yes.
So it's kind of a no-win situation for the good guy. You have to really... You need better writers than Nitro had for something like that to work.
Sure, yes. You need to focus... You need some sort of, element of continuity, an element of, like, remembering how things work. And yeah, Nitro was never great at that, so...
No. All right. Yeah, good. I enjoyed this. I mean, my opinion of this match isn't great because I'm not grading it on a curve. And I watched it after Rey and Cena, to my credit.
Fair enough.
And it is worse than Rey and Cena.
It is worse than Rey and Cena. I agree with that. I just, I enjoy it. I mean, whether it's good or not,
sure.
Maybe it's not that good, but I enjoy it. So.
Oh, I totally see it. And I think Brian Barrera on Twitter was like, yeah, I love that match too. And I totally see why people love the match. but I think I just got dropped in out of context. I feel like maybe I should have watched the whole Nitro leading up to it or something. That would have helped.
I don't
that
know. If, often I honestly helps. Don't know if that would have helped. Yeah, I honestly.
Oh, think, no, maybe not.
I honestly think this is, might be a better match out of context than in context.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that's a possibility. You know, I could be wrong about that, but I feel like that's sort of that's kind of like the nice thing about both these matches is that they work. I mean, they work okay in context, but they work even better as, you know, they work even better outside of context. They work better in whatever context you kind of want to put them in because they're basically the appealing thing about both matches. The most appealing thing to me is that they are both matches that are just so rare that makes them interesting in and of themselves.
Absolutely. And so speaking, and you're absolutely right about Cena and Rey being better out of context, because I remember watching this live and I had such a bad taste in my mouth at the time.
Yes.
The story surrounding this seemed cruel, like unnecessarily cruel to Rey Mysterio. And in a way that made John Cena seem really cruel. So let's get into this. So this is the year 2011, and we are in the summer of a man named CM Punk,
yes,
who has caused some problems in the story,
yeah,
by defeating John Cena for the WWE Championship and then immediately quitting with the championship.
Put it in the
which
fridge.
Is apparently something you can do. Yeah, he put it in his fridge, which is apparently something you can do. I was always under the impression that if you quit, you were no longer the champion.
Yes.
But apparently this is not the case. So they held a they did what a cromulent NWA commission would order in the old days, is if there's no champion, we need a champion,
sure,
and we should have a tournament. That makes sense.
I can imagine Bob Geigel making that decision, you know, making that announcement on television, and you know, and everyone just, you know, applauding the, you know, the leadership of the committee, and you know, taking care of, we need a champion after all. It's very important that we have a champion.
It's very important that we have a champion.
Yes.
And
not a champion who puts the title in his refrigerator. Obviously,
that's correct.
Disrespectful. That's...
What kind of man, Jason?
I'm not sure. I'm not, you know, a man that I certainly don't want to see.
Wow, 2016 John Cena, Rey Mysterio, and CM Punk are very different than 2011 John Cena, Rey Mysterio, and CM Punk, aren't they?
It's been a long time.
It has been. It's been a really, really long time.
Yeah.
I feel like 2011 to 2016, it's been 50 years.
Approximately,
and,
yes.
And 2006 to 2011 didn't feel that long.
No. Strange times for some. So yeah.
Very strange times.
So
he left. They had a tournament.
Right.
Rey Mysterio wins the tournament. Wins his first WWE Championship in a great moment. And they have this awesome backstage celebration. And his first opponent is the man who previously lost the WWE Championship and deservedly has a rematch coming his way. And no one disagrees with that, really.
No.
John Cena. The problem is that these two events did not happen, say, weeks apart or with lots of build or anything. Rey Mysterio won the WWE Championship 25 minutes into this episode of Raw, and then about 1 hour later had to defend it against John Cena.
Yes, it was an odd bit of pacing, for sure. And they had – so the tournament had actually occurred the prior week. And then they were about to do the finale as the main event. And then they have this segment where Triple H removes Vince McMahon from power as chairman of the board and calls him Pops, and there's crying and, you know, and what have you. So it's fine. You know, you have that emotional arc or whatever, you move the match to next week, and it's a great moment at the beginning, and you know, it's really exciting, and it's like, oh, Rey Mysterio won, which was pretty unexpected, because I think Miz would have been the favorite here. He had been prior champion earlier in the year. Mysterio not really had been doing a whole lot in 2011, I feel like. I mean, you know, he was around, but he wasn't
he'd been feuding with CM Punk, and they had a really, really great finale match to their story about a month before at the previous pay-per-view.
Oh, that's right. I'd forgotten about the timing of that. Yeah, that's right.
And
yeah.
So Ray was
June,
actually
yeah.
kind of on a high. Like
Okay.
he had won that feud. Everyone considered it a good feud. Their WrestleMania match is still pretty memorable. So he was in an okay spot, but I don't think anybody was thinking that he was about to win the title.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was very odd. So yeah, I mean, they try to kind of work around the idea of, I mean, Lawler does mention and emphasizes that Cena has the advantage over Ray because he's wrestled twice and that Cena only had to wrestle once. And Cena isn't necessarily gleeful about the idea of beating Ray here, but he certainly, like, he doesn't fight, you know, the idea of, oh, let's just do it next week, or hey, let's do it at SummerSlam. You know, that would make a lot more sense.
He does not once say, hey, this is weird. He's just like, hey, I get a championship shot. Lucky me.
Yeah. I forget the circumstances where he is given that shot, because I thought he had been taken off of, like, you know, Vince had sort not that he like threatened to fire him, and
so
then,
that's exactly it. So Vince had kept Cena out of the tournament because he'd failed in beating CM Punk.
Right,
that was sort of his punishment.
Yes.
So Triple H ousts Vince, and Triple H does the right thing by giving Cena this opportunity. Which, I mean, again, that all makes sense. This all sounds like it makes sense, but the fact that it all happens on one episode of Raw, and Rey Mysterio is a good guy,
yes,
and John Cena is a good guy.
They're both goodest guys,
They're both the goodest of guys. It's just super odd. The commentary team makes no mention of the fact that this seems unfair to Rey Mysterio.
Yeah, other than Lawler does say, hey, you know, Cena has the advantage here. But yeah, there is no sense of like, oh, this is an injustice, or this is not, you know,
right.
This is,
yeah.
You know,
they do not frame it as a punishment to Rey Mysterio.
Right. When it clearly is, obviously.
And it wouldn't be so weird if this wasn't Rey Mysterio's one reign as WWE champion.
Right, that's a good point. Yeah, this was like his fifth time or whatever he'd been
sure,
champion. And
he'd
been world champion, so you know not that there's a huge difference between the two belts, but the WWE one was definitely the more prestigious one, especially at this point.
Especially in 2011.
Right. Yeah.
Hell, you're right. Even Bret Hart has one 24-hour championship. going
yeah,
on.
Right. Yeah, if that's like part of, you know, I'm sure Cena has had some short reigns too. So we've seen this circumstance, but it is, yeah, it's unusual with it's a pretty emotional win for Ray early on in the show, and then that's just completely undercut with Andrew Cena, and it also it kind of plays into, and I guess that might be intentional. It kind of plays into the idea. You know, part of Punk's earlier complaint is that Cena is a favored son who is treated differently than everybody else, and
mm-hmm.
that, you know, and he paints himself, of course, as the opposite of that. And I guess that somewhat works as another, you know, if you're on Punk's side in that fight, Cena's, behavior here, the way that he is given this advantage, definitely works in his favor. But I don't recall him really making anything of that when he comes back.
No, that's the crazy thing, is they make nothing of it. This match is immediately forgotten. Rey Mysterio is not in the title picture after this. He doesn't keep challenging for it. He doesn't get another... He never gets a rematch.
He does not, no. Yeah.
You know? So it's crazy, because I feel like Alberto Del Rio's involvement in this match... Because I think Ray would fight Del Rio for, I think, a few weeks after this. So I was under the impression that it was going like, oh, Ray loses the title here. He fights Del Rio. He gets some revenge. And then he goes back after the title. That's what I thought they were doing. But no, they just, I guess Ray was just like, was it a weird contract thing where they were just like, well, Ray has like one title in his contract. Let's get it over with. Is that how it worked here? I'd love to hear someone's side of the story about this specific episode of Raw.
Yes. So Ray was in a six-man tag team match at SummerSlam with Kofi Kingston and John Morrison against Awesome Truth and Alberto Del Rio in the
Well, that definitely sounds like he was in the main event.
Yes.
Obviously.
Obviously, yes.
Clearly a big deal.
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah. Wow. I think he may have gotten hurt after this, because he's not he doesn't seem to be involved in the next pay-per-views. So
I would have gotten hurt after this if this had been my night.
Yes. Yes.
Would have been like, no, I'm hurt. I'm staying home now for the next 4 years.
So getting to the match, so Ray, he kicks Cena's quad repeatedly and causes him anguish.
Yep.
Then Cena gets a knuckle lock. Ray gets on top of his shoulders and turns into a sunset flip. Then he works a headlock, and Cena keeps trying to send Ray off, but Ray, you know, will make a counter move and keeps relocking it in. And then mm-hmm. Cena finally permanently breaks it with a back suplex. But they have a nice little sequence there. The Ray does an excellent job, I feel like, at counter wrestling. That's one of the
yes.
things that he is so fantastic at. And also, he is able to, I mean, a lot of the counters are things that you've seen in matches before, but he'll always work in, or often work in, one or two things that are different from the usual, which I you know, coming out of a move in a different way than you don't expect.
Yeah. Oh, I love, I mean, I make no secret of being a huge Rey Mysterio fan.
Oh yeah.
And even in this period of time where I feel like he's 30 or 40 pounds heavier than he should be, and he's clearly working at half speed and even slower with John Cena, who is someone who is not used to working with cruiserweights.
Sure.
It's very, very rare to see John Cena in a match with somebody who is smaller than him.
Yeah.
Like, I thought it was strange to see Cena and Miz working together, because Miz is so much smaller, but Rey is even more so.
Yeah.
So a lot of...
Go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I do think they do a nice job of having Rey totally look like he can hang with Cena, and Cena working in a way where the size difference doesn't, like, it doesn't seem like absurd that Cena
yeah.
is like, it totally, he totally makes Rey look great with everything that Rey does. Where, when Rey wrestles with some of the really big guys, I feel like sometimes they have trouble with that. But here,
yeah.
Cena totally is able to, you know, work big and work small in element,
mm-hmm.
and it totally connects. There's no issue there at all.
There definitely are moments like at the end of this headlock sequence, like Cena goes for a pin, and they get into the corner, and Rey's coming at Cena, and Cena just kind of shoves him off, and Rey flies to the other end of the ring.
Yes.
Just based purely on Cena's shove.
Sure.
Like I think, yeah, he goes for a bulldog, and Cena, or no, he hits the bulldog, pins him. What happens here? And yeah, he basically shoves him away, and he goes halfway across the ring.
Right.
So there's definitely elements where it's like, oh, no. Cena is still super strong here. He's not actually pulling his punches.
Yeah, I mean, they do a nice job of making it tense, but I don't feel like it gets to the point where it's like, you know, big bad John Cena bullying poor Rey Mysterio. I mean, they do work a little bit of that in, but it's not they don't make it the story of the match. It's not, you know, Cena, you know, the underdog Rey trying to come up against John Cena. It's two guys who are basically on an equal level, just, you know, working a wrestling match. With as Lawler notes later, Cena does not throw a punch during the entire match.
Yeah, and I love them for it. I mean, I love wrestling matches that don't really involve punches.
Yeah.
I think punches, I've always thought this, I think wrestling shouldn't have punches in it. Not because I think it's, not because it doesn't look real or whatever, but because wrestlers don't know how to punch, and it always looks lousy, and it always takes me out of the performance. I think wrestlers should clothesline each other.
Yeah.
Instead.
Jerry Lawler can punch, but everybody else, you know.
He's the only one.
Yeah.
He's the only one. Like they go to the outside not too long after that, and Cena hits Rey Mysterio with a wicked lariat.
Yes.
Always a big fan of the John Cena lariat.
It's a good one.
It's one of his best moves. I always thought he should have turned that into a finishing move for like lower level matches. Like that should be his, I didn't really break a sweat finishing move.
Yeah, I do like it's a good idea for a secondary one. I feel like the only issue is that Bradshaw had that, but I guess maybe like once he beat Bradshaw, he could have that could have been like I like the idea sometimes of like when you conquer a guy in a feud. Like sometimes if you have a long enough feud, some of the guys will start using each other's move. Obviously, as you
absolutely,
know, and I feel like you should be able to like. As a reward for winning a feud, you should be able to like use his finisher like afterward, you know, later on as part of the, you know, the, your spoils for winning the feud.
That is the kind of wrestling logic that warms my heart. It's very Nature Boy, right? It's very like Ric Flair won the name Nature Boy in a match.
Yes, eventually. I think he used it first, and then Buddy Rogers took exception to it. Then they did eventually have a match, but
yeah.
But
that kind of thing where it's like,
yeah,
like I'm going to steal this from you as a trophy.
Sure.
Yeah. And because that's the kind of thing that wrestling fans have. Wrestling fans have such a unique memory for detail. That like if John Cena had made it a thing to be like, no, Bradshaw, I destroyed you so much that I'm taking your clothesline and making a point of it. Wrestling fans would remember that forever.
Yes.
And every time he used that clothesline, it would be the clothesline that he stole from Bradshaw.
Yeah, that would be a nice. I obviously it's a detail that I would enjoy as well. That one of those like little, you know, like I nod your history without going over the top with it.
Exactly. Like wrestling matches should know about other matches. Like regardless of the wrestlers, like the moves themselves should be informed by the past.
Yes. Yes. So after the outside. After that clothesline outside, Cena drags Rey in, but only gets two. And then Cena works a waist lock on the mat, sort of using his weight to as the heavier man. Eventually, Rey elbows out of it, hits a DDT. Then he misses an enziguri, and Cena tries the STF. Rey immediately gets to the ropes. And then Rey drops Cena's neck on the ropes, which looks really looks pretty vicious. And then gets a two count with a rope-assisted moonsault.
Yeah. Like, just talk about, like, good, fun, offensive stuff from Rey.
Yeah. Yeah, the nice little variety mix of things there. The neck drop on the ropes is really good. Then he tries a 619, but Cena catches it and then hits a power slam for two. Then Rey later jumps off the ropes, hits a dropkick, and they are both slow to get up. And then we get a series of fun counters from Mysterio. He counters the Cena protobomb. But then gets caught off the ropes into another. Then Cena sets up the five knuckle shuffle and hits it. Then tries to put him in the attitude adjustment, but Rey fights out of it. Gets caught off the ropes, but then he reverses that into an arm drag and then lands a drop kick, which actually gets two. And actually, despite the fact that it's a drop kick and got two, actually was at a point in the match where I felt like, okay, this is reasonably believable that Cena has taken enough punishment to be pinned here.
I've always looked at that like Cena will always let the guy get a two count on him.
Yeah.
Almost always. It's very rare that Cena will do the asshole thing and kick out a one. I always thought like that commentators will always say that, you know, you should try to kick out quickly, but why? Like you get a rest of 2 seconds. If you know you're going to kick out, take the 2 seconds.
I wonder if there's if I'm looking at it realistically, I wonder if there's like the worry that the ref may accidentally count fast, or maybe he'll hook the leg after one and I won't be able to get like the you know, the proper momentum or whatever, you know.
Oh, you know what it is? I've been listening to too much Jesse the Body Ventura commentary. that's what's in my head right now. Yeah. Like, take every advantage you can get.
Yes. Well, you know, I guess like the old style psychology, like, you know, Florida 1970s Jack Briscoe was the idea that you always kicked out at one, and then if you got two on a guy, like if you got two on the champion, that was a really big deal because nobody gets two on the champion, much less beat him. I mean, that added like that made that two count even more important in that context because, you know, nobody, you know, was able to get two on the champion before that. So that's sort of an interesting wrestling thing that's, you know, been completely forgotten over the years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that like as to, I don't think anybody really asks this question as to why there is a three count. Because like in amateur wrestling, there's no three count. So why did they add a three count? They didn't get that from boxing. There's a 10 count over there. Why does wrestling get a three count? And it's because it's really, really fun to count to three.
You know what? I cannot think of a better explanation than that. So
it's really fun and it's suspenseful.
Yes.
Right. It's, if it was just one, it wouldn't be any fun to play along.
Right.
Right. Like and, if it,
and five is too long.
And five is too long. Although sometimes five is the right number to count to. Sometimes three isn't enough.
That's true. If you're King Kong Bundy, for instance, you know, obviously,
or Big E Langston.
Yeah, there you go.
I love that Big E used the King Kong Bundy gimmick for a while. It was awesome.
Yeah. So,
but yeah, I love the King Kong Bundy five count.
Yes.
It's the kicking out at one or two communicates something.
Right.
We can both agree on this. What it communicates, we can disagree on, but the fact that it does communicate something.
Yeah.
And Cena, I don't think he's a one count guy. I don't think he's ever really been the, I'm just going to get out at one and just be, cause he's already Superman. He's already invincible. He doesn't need that one too.
No, that's a good point. Mm-hmm. So Ray hits a drop toe hold that sends Cena into the turnbuckle. Then Ray goes off the top with a senton splash. He then locks Cena with the STF and holds it on it for a good long while. But then Cena eventually lifts Ray up on one leg, powers him onto his shoulders, but Cena's leg gives way and he collapses.
That was great pretty cool. Sequence.
Yeah.
Great sequence.
Yeah.
Ray, like the STF is kind of a great wrestling move to cut someone down to size, because you don't need to be as tall as them to hook in that move.
Yeah, I always thought Ray should do more submission stuff like that. Could have, like, that being a bigger element of what he did. I mean, Ray's awesome, so who am I to criticize what he does? But I always kind of felt like that was the one thing that he could have done a little bit more. Like, if he had done, like, the Taz mission, for instance. Like, he can get a big guy in the Taz mission, and, it, you know,
sure.
that kind of thing. And I always kind of felt like if they were going to, you know, be serious about making him, like, a, you know, the kind of person who would be a long-term champion, that would have been a good way to go about it. But, you know, whatever. It's
you think Dean Malenko would have taught him something.
You would have thought so, yeah. You know?
But, yeah, the moment when John Cena's knee gave out, I thought the match was over. I thought Ray was going to hit that 619, and that was going to be it. That was the moment that caught me.
Yeah. I mean, it was really good, and there's no reason for you to think that Ray's going to win here. Obviously, I mean, the way the story is set up, it's seen as to take the belt. I mean, we kind of see what's happening here, but yeah, the fact that they are able to make it look so good and make it to a point where you feel like Ray could win is, you know, give credit to the action in the ring and the crowd for being invested in it.
Right after that kick out, down on the lower left corner of the screen, one of my favorite graphics pops up, which is that the WWE Championship glowing, or like glowing belt in the lower left corner to remind us that this is a championship match.
Well, it's a good reminder, you know.
It's a great reminder, and sometimes I just wish that would just happen in regular life. That just you'd be walking around, and then that little reminder, would come up and remind you that you, sir, are in a championship match.
Or maybe like if you're like in a job interview, like there's like a little like you know, some dollar signs that come up, like it's like, okay, you're interviewing for this is for the All the Marbles, you know.
The $1 million title should pop up at that moment.
Yes. If you want to put $1 million in your 401k, you better get this job, you know? So
and it's such a little passive. They don't do it anymore. This was something they did for a few years. There was like a production person who put that in, and they don't put that there anymore.
Oh, that's disappointing.
But I really liked that little, just a little reminder, just in case you forgot that this is an important one.
Yeah. So at this point, So Ray hits the 619, as we mentioned, goes to the top rope, but then a splash hits Cena in his weakened knee. So Cena is grabbing his knee. Ray then jumps up to, with Cena in the corner, he jumps up to the top to try a Hurricanrana, but Cena hits a powerbomb instead, and Ray lands very awkwardly on his shoulder, flipping backward, which the announcers make note of. I did not mention that Jim Ross is the announcer here. I guess we alluded to it because Cole was not the announcer for the...
I was wondering why this match was good.
Because the earlier match, Michael Cole is doing commentary with for the Miz Ray match that opens the show, and then at some point, I think one of Triple H's things that he does, you know, to ingratiate himself to the fans is to bring back Jim Ross and to have him be commentator and to send Cole away, or maybe he goes to SmackDown. I forget exactly the details, but
he gives Cole the night off to think about his future.
There you go.
Yeah.
Then Cena hits the top rope leg drop on Ray. It's actually like, at first I thought it was the Famouser, the one that he usually does, but actually Ray's facing the other way. He's sort of like sitting up. It's not exactly like totally a perfect, he's not flat on the ground, but it's done very well. It's done very, a lot of times that will look very awkward, but they timed it really, really well.
Did you groan heavily when that happened? Because that looked incredibly brutal. That was the most brutal move of the match to me, that top rope leg drop, because Cena's leg is the size of Mysterio's torso. This is a Scott Steiner situation. The proportions of John Cena is unfair in a move like that.
Sure.
And it's a little funny to me that, like, the most impressive aerial maneuver in this match is not a Rey Mysterio move.
That is interesting. Yes. Speaks to where Rey was athletically at this point, you know, after all those knee injuries,
right. That's the thing.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't have a career like Rey Mysterio without destroying many, many knees.
Yeah. So Cena, he stands, waits for Rey, and then sits Rey on his shoulders. Ray is able to fend him off. He tries the 619 again, but then Cena catches Mysterio, puts him on top of his shoulders, and hits the attitude adjustment for the 3 and to win the WWE Championship.
Mm-hmm. He does the sort of nice, respectful pin where he does the old school hook the arm and the leg.
Yes. Yes.
Like he's John Cena is trying his best
to not defeat. Yes.
He's trying his best to, like, be sportsmanlike, but he's also literally trying his best.
Yes, he's coming off in, like, he's coming off in a way in which he is trying to emphasize the fact that he respects Rey Mysterio, but doing it too, it's like a doth protest too much type thing.
A little. He comes across a little bit like the captain of the football team here.
Yes.
Where it's just like, No, you don't understand. You are doing the right things, but there are some underlying reasons as to why you're the worst.
Yes. So, and then immediately afterward, he goes over. He picks up Ray and tends to him, and then he holds up his hand to salute him as, you know, the great, you know, fight that they have had. Ray leaves, and then Cult of Personality comes on the over the speaker system, you know. And now I had forgotten that this was the first time that Cult of Personality had been played as CM Punk's theme. Like, I just hit
it.
You
were wondering, like, why does no one know who this is?
Right. And then Punk comes out and the crowd reacts, and I'm like, oh, yeah, this was the first time I did that. And then Punk walks into the ring, and they both sort of look at each other, and they hold up their titles, and as if each of them is the proper champion, and we have a manufactured title controversy.
You know what I really love about this scene, and this is something that WWE is very, very good at, when they have two wrestlers and one wrestler has to leave so that a third wrestler can come in and be the important person in the new scene, but the third person is coming from the entrance ramp. You don't want the loser of the previous match to be seen on the entrance ramp. And Rey Mysterio is not seen anymore. The second he loses, right, John Cena picks him up, shakes his hand, Rey Mysterio leaves, but there's no way that Ray had time to walk up the entrance ramp before CM Punk's music plays.
Right.
So where is Rey Mysterio right now? Rey Mysterio is almost certainly crouched on one side of the ring that the cameras are not going to point to. Almost certainly. If you've been to a live WWE Raw, you have seen this happen, where a character is no longer in the scene, but he has no way to leave, so he just crouches in the corner until the scene is over.
Can they not? I mean, sometimes they will go, like, you can escape, like, on the side of the ramp.
It's possible, yeah. But I don't think there was time.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I once saw Booker T do that. He was, like, kind of crouched for about 8 minutes.
That doesn't seem like fun. That's almost.
Seem like fun.
That's almost as bad as Davey Boy Smith being knocked out for 20 minutes at Survivor Series 94 and nobody bothering to check on him.
Oh, poor guy.
So, yeah, you mean, I don't know. Do we want to get into, like, how silly it is to have CM Punk come back two weeks after after walking out? Or do we need to not bother to rehash that one again?
Hold on. I need to just send a quick text.
Okay.
Stick the winner at SummerSlam. Okay, I'm good. Sorry, what were you saying?
We haven't talked about Kevin Nash yet, so I guess it's probably a good opportunity.
Yeah, this is all roads lead back to Kevin Nash. So the first match, we talked about Goldberg and how that was a really competitive match for Goldberg, and everyone thought, hey, maybe that'll be the match that ends the streak. Nope. Turns out they're going to the fireworks factory.
Yep.
and this match also leads to Kevin Nash.
Yeah.
That's the theme. We found the theme. The theme is interesting stories that Kevin Nash would ruin 3 months later.
Right. Yeah, that's about right. Yeah, that totally fits. Yeah. All right, so I'm glad that we can work in Kevin Nash somewhere organically. Mm-hmm. It's always nice when it surprises us rather than us trying to force it in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, I can send texts to the past. I didn't realize that. This is a good phone.
That's nice. I guess technically, once you send the text, it's always in the past.
True or worse. That's a very good point.
Yeah.
All right,
that's good, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anything else we should discuss?
No. Never.
anything you want to plug that you're doing?
No, I'm not doing anything right now. I think the last time we did a show was at WrestleMania.
Yes.
And I think you asked me if I had anything to plug, and I was like, not really. I'm working on a book or something like that, and I'm still exactly there.
Okay.
It
takes time to write a book, you know.
Oh my god, it does. Don't ever do that.
All right, I'll try not to.
And that goes to anyone listening. Don't write a book; it will ruin your life.
Okay. Don't follow your dreams, kids. We heard it here first.
Oh, definitely don't follow your dreams. I mean, you saw what happened to Rey Mysterio.
That's a good point, man. I mean, if we take no other lesson other than that, I think that's a pretty good one.
I mean, I'd like to think he's happier in Lucha Underground, but you know, he's fighting next week Chavo fucking Guerrero.
Again. Ray just can't get rid of that guy.
No.
Oh, poor Ray. Well, yeah. Oh well. Oh well.
What can you do?
What can he do? All right, everyone. Well, hopefully you are enjoying what's going on. Hopefully you enjoyed this episode, and we'll try to do more. We'll see about that. Mm-hmm. So thanks.
This was fun.
Yeah, I had fun as well. So we'll try to have fun occasionally talking about wrestling and not making too big of a deal of it, because, you know, who wants that?
Oh, my God.
So no. Everyone can follow me on Twitter at WrestleSpective. You are at _SawyerPaul, I believe.
I am.
And then, of course, you can find WrestleSpective on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you want to give it a rating or review, if you like it, I would greatly appreciate it. If not, no big deal. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back again soon.